Today on the Grave Talks, Christmas ghost stories. Who's ready for a Christmas ghost story? Author Sylvia Schultz has compiled one of the best collections of true ghost stories from the ghosts of Christmas past. We hear the all-too-real story behind a famous tale told by Edgar Allan Poe and how it came to be. The tale of a man who loved Christmas music so much that even after his passing, the music continues to play from the side of his cabin in the woods. Also, the true story of a train tragedy that occurred around the holidays. It takes a life of nearly 100 individuals. Years after, the train lights can still be seen. But who is on board? These and many other ghostly Christmas stories on today's special holiday edition of The Grave Talks.
Well, I am always on the lookout for interesting ideas to turn into books. And the way this came about was absolutely out of the blue. I work at a library, and I had just finished up writing, working on 44 Years in Darkness, I believe. But I was casting around for another idea, just wondering what the next idea would be. And I went to the book drop and pulled out, I think it was either a CD of Christmas songs or a book on CD of Amish Christmas stories, like Amish-themed Christmas stories. Mm-hmm. And the light bulb went on. I said, oh, Christmas ghost stories! Yeah!
Yeah.
So there was the next book, and I pitched it to my publisher, and I went and looked to see how many books of Christmas stories, of ghost stories, were out there, and I thought the market was just going to be saturated, but it turns out there's not a lot out there. And I pitched it to the publisher, and he said, oh, yeah, you could write about this and this and this. Hey, wait a minute. Why am I not writing this book? No, I'm kidding. Go ahead. Write it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. So, I mean, it's a topic that obviously there's ghost stories in a lot of European culture, American culture, not a lot of connectivity with the ghosts unless you're watching, certain movies and such. But it is a topic that you're exactly right. You would think there'd be more out there on it. We get a lot of stories around Christmas time on both of our shows from folks who said, hey, you know, I got together my family for Christmas and I heard this ghost story or that ghost story. So when you decided, hey, I'm going to do a book about Christmas ghost stories, concept is great, but then digging in and finding them, how did that go?
Well, I am a fiend for reading. I will sit down and read before I do anything else. So my research for this basically consisted of sitting down and reading every book of true ghost stories I could possibly get my greasy little paws on, mm-hmm. and picking out the ones that happened in December, sure. And Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. And once I got that collection of stories, of material, then I broke that down into what's a creepy story that happened any time in the winter, and then mm-hmm. any time in December, and then Christmas Eve and Christmas Day.
Okay. So there's obviously a lot that you found. What do you think it is about the holidays and Christmas when it comes to true ghost stories? Why is it that sometimes spirits seem to make themselves known at that time of year?
Well, Christmas happens to fall very, very close to the winter solstice. That's when the darkest night of the year, it's the night with the day with the longest nighttime hours and the fewest hours of daylight. And we've got the summer solstice, and that's wonderful. We're out having picnics, and it's the longest day of the year and the shortest night, and we have all these hours of sunshine. But during the winter solstice, it's exactly the opposite. It's chilly. It's spooky. There's more hours of darkness than at any other time during the year. And that's, I think, why the veil gets a little thin during the winter solstice. And Christmas time is a very good time for telling ghost stories. I mean, we think, well, you know, ghost stories, the window of opportunity for that closed November 1st, didn't it? but it's really a good time to huddle indoors and keep warm by the fire and tell ghost stories to keep yourselves entertained. What? And also, if you put up if you harvest your apples in October and press them into apple cider and let it sit, by the time Christmas rolls around, you've got a really good batch of Applejack brewing.
And if you hit it too soon, it's just spoiled apple juice.
Right. But so, if you save it till Christmas.
Just got to let it sit. Be patient with it. So another thing that comes to mind just over the years of getting ghost stories from folks on our shows, obviously, the Christmas being a time of year that it runs the gamut of emotions. There's happy memories. There's lonesome memories. It can be a joyful time or it can
be regretful,
depressing. It can be everything. So I think that probably plays a bit into it as well, as far as just the human emotion side and the energy side of things when people are in that time of year, whether they're with loved ones or not. So let's jump into some of these stories that you discovered and take us through some of the most poignant ones that have stood out to you in your research in your book.
Okay, absolutely. The first one I'm going to share with you involves the horror writer Edgar Allan Poe. Poe was born in Boston on January 19th, 1809, and when he was 18 years old, he enlisted in the Army. And his first posting was at Fort Independence on Castle Island in Boston Harbor. So he wasn't very far from home. He just had a hop, skip, and a jump for his first Army posting. So one of the Sundays he was there, he had some free time, so he decided to walk around this island and explore the fort that was his new home. And he wandered down outside the fort's walls, down to the water's edge, and he found a monument there with some inscriptions on it. He was like, well, that's kind of weird. Let's check this out. So on one side of this monument, there was an inscription: "The officers of the U.S. Regiment of Lieutenant Erty erected this monument as a testimony of their respect and friendship for an amiable man and gallant officer." And Poe was like, wonder what the story is. And then on the other side of the monument, he found another piece of the puzzle. It said, "Beneath this stone are the deposited the remains of Lieutenant Robert F. Massey of the U.S. Regiment of Light Artillery. Near this spot, on the 25th December 1817, fell Lieutenant Robert F. Massey, aged 21 years." And Poe, being a budding writer, said, "All right, there's a story here. I'm going to find out what it is." So he started asking around very quietly to see if anyone knew the story behind this monument. So what he discovered was that 10 years earlier, in the summer of 1817, there was a lieutenant named Robert Massey posted at the fort. Everybody liked this guy. He got along with everybody. He was fair to his men, and he was a good companion to the other officers. But there was another fellow at the fort. His name was Captain Green. And he was just a bully, plain and simple. Nobody got along with him. He was just a jerk. But Robert Massey tried to make friends with Captain Green, and it just wasn't working. So Christmas Eve, Massey, Green, and a couple other officers they got together for a game of cards, and they're playing cards, and Massey won the hand of cards they were playing just about midnight on Christmas Eve, and he put his winning hand down and he said, "Hey, Merry Christmas to me," you know? And Lieutenant Green, or Captain Green rather, got up and just smacked Robert Massey across the face. He said, "You cheated. You cheated, and I demand satisfaction," which meant a duel. And Massey was like, "I can't back out of this. Even on Christmas Day, that's the rules of the duel. You can't back out." So on Christmas Day, he and his second went to the dueling grounds, and they had a duel, and Captain Green was bound and determined to win, and he ran Robert Massey through and killed him. So Robert Massey's friends buried him with all the honors and decided to do a little digging about this Green character. And what they found was that Green had a history of picking fights with guys. He was basically a serial killer with the sanction of social custom on his side. He would pick duels with people and he would kill them. So not a nice character at all.
Mm-hmm.
So Robert Massey was buried with all the honors, and pretty soon after Massey was buried, Captain Green just sort of disappeared. And there was an effort to look for him because he was an army guy, but the higher-ups decided, well, he just went AWOL, I guess, and he was just quietly forgotten. But what actually happened was that a few nights after Massey's death, Massey's friends went to Green's room with a bottle of booze and a couple of glasses and invited Green to start drinking with them. And they kept filling his cup, and he was like tossing them back, and they got him knee-walking drunk. Then they grabbed him by his arms and frog-marched him out to the fort, to the deepest, darkest dungeon cell they could find. And by the time he sobered up to realize what was happening, they had chained him to the wall and had started bricking up the cell. It probably took Green a very, very long time to die in the pitch blackness, screaming for help that would never come. Edgar Allan Poe found out about this 10 years later. And he was sniffing around doing some research. He's like, this is a really cool story. And the higher-ups called him into the office and said, look, this is army business. Don't go poking around. Don't go telling this story. Don't go spreading the story around. And Poe's like, it's okay. I won't tell anybody the story. That's fine. But then he started writing, started his career, and he was like, nobody said I couldn't write about this. So Edgar Allan Poe wrote a story called The Cask of Amontillado, which involves someone being buried alive mm-hmm. in retribution. So there's Poe's inspiration for The Cask of Amontillado.
Very interesting.
There's a little more to the story.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is very interesting to hear the backstory on what one of these stories is. Continue on.
Well, in 1905, they were doing some restoration work on the fort, on this old Revolutionary War fort, 1812 era fort, and they were comparing the prison cells that they knew about to the fort's original floor plans, and they realized this restoration crew realized that the cells didn't quite match up. So they're like, doing their exploration of these prison cells, these dungeon cells, and they're like this bricked up area of wall, and they're like, well, that's not on the floor plans. What's going on here? So they start taking the bricks off, and they shine a flashlight in, and one guy kind of sticks his head through the hole, and he jumps back out again real quick, and he goes, there's a skeleton in there. And they take more of the wall down, and they shine brighter flashlights in, and there was a skeleton dressed in the tattered remains of an 1812-era army uniform. The wrist bones were still enclosed in shackles, rusty shackles. There were shackles around his ankles, and the skeleton's jaw was open in a silent scream.
Wow. That's just one of those stories where you're like, this could be in a movie, you know, but it's like this is why movies get those ideas, because a lot of times this stuff happened somewhere and that happens to be where it happened. That's a great it didn't involve Christmas trees and it didn't involve Santa Clauses, but it certainly would be one hell of an entertaining Christmas day if you were a witness to the original duel day of that. Families don't do duels anymore on Christmas. Unfortunately, that kind of came out of fashion years ago. I don't know. I say give it time. I think it could come back the way that a lot of family gatherings have been going in the last couple of years.
Oh, heavens.
All the opposition.
Bring in politics and, you get duels all over the place.
I think we could start seeing this happen again in the next couple of years. Just wait.
Let's bring this back. Make it a thing.
A renaissance Christmas, so to speak. So tell me another Christmas ghost story that is in your archive, in your book, The Spirits of Christmas.
Okay, well, here's a really wonderful one. We'll go from gruesome to heartwarming.
Okay.
And a little bit spooky, too, because these are ghost stories. Mm-hmm. There was a fellow who retired from the Baltimore and Ohio rail line, and this engineer was known for his love of the Christmas season. Every December, he would buy just sack loads of candy and make up little bags of candy, and whenever the train would pass by, kids' backyards where the kids were waiting to wave at the train, he'd toss these sacks of candy out to the kids just in celebration, like this rolling mobile Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. And he would sing Christmas carols on the train all December, and just, he was a really jolly guy. Now, when he retired, he got enough from his retirement package to buy a phonograph and a set of Christmas records. So he just really enjoyed, he had this little house out in the woods, and he just enjoyed filling the woods with the sounds of Christmas. He passed away in the late 1950s, early 1960s. So his relatives cleaned out his little tiny house and took his phonograph and took his records, and somebody else got them. And this little tiny house was left empty in the woods. In 1968, the B&O tracks were taken up and not replaced. They just left the rail bed there as a trail. And the old man's house was taken down as well, so there's not even a crumb left of it. The only thing that was left was this track bed, and hunters would use it to go in and out of the woods. Mm-hmm. So years and years after the old man died, not long after 1968 when his house was torn down, there was a hunter out in the woods 2 days before Christmas, and he was driving his truck along this track bed looking for a good place to get out and hunt. So he had stopped. He was driving very slowly, listening to the sounds of the forest around him. And he stopped because he heard something really out of place in the middle of a forest. He started hearing Christmas music. And it wasn't only Christmas music, it was Christmas music that was obviously being played on an old vinyl record, mm-hmm. on a very old Victrola record player. And he stopped his car and he turned off the engine. He's listening more carefully. And he's like, am I just hearing things? What's going on? And all around his truck, this music was just threading through the trees. And he's like, okay, I'm really hearing this. This is weird. And then he goes to start his car, and his car won't start. And he's pumping the ignition, and he's pumping the gas, and he's cranking the key, trying to get the car to start, and it just wouldn't turn over. And then the hunter, something caught his eye moving in front of him, and he saw the ghost of an old man crossing the track bed. And the specter of the old man crossed the track bed and walked to an old house that had suddenly appeared in amongst the trees. And the guy, the ghost of the old man, went into the house, closed the door, and as he did, the music got fainter and fainter, and finally disappeared altogether. And as soon as the music stopped, the hunter was able to start his car. And he slewed out of those woods. He came to town. He told everybody what was going on. He's like, this is scary. This is spooky. This is creepy. And a couple of teenage boys heard this story too. So they're like, oh man, we got to go out and check this out. So the next day, Christmas Eve, they go out in their car, and they're hoping to have the same experience. They're like, this guy was scared out of his wits, but we really want to hear this. So they drove on the track bed out to where the old engineer's house used to be, and they turned off their cars, and they waited. Now, they didn't see the old man or the house, but they did hear the Christmas music. And it sounded just like an old Victrola with a scratchy record that still worked, and they heard the music. And again, it wasn't until the music stopped that they were able to start their cars and drive out of the woods. And they went back out a few nights after Christmas, but no dice. Nothing happened. It was just quiet winter woods. So the legend has it that this only happens in these woods during the days leading up to Christmas Day. And after Christmas Day, it's over for another year.
Do you think something like that, when that occurs, is it a conscious entity, a conscious ghost, where he's literally back there and he's turning it on because it's Christmas time? Or is it something to do with the cycle of the seasons and the residual, you know, energy that was there around that time for so many years from that gentleman who had such a passion for Christmas?
I would really love to think that that's an intelligent haunting, mm-hmm. but it has all the earmarks of a residual haunting to me. Unfortunately, I would love to think it's actually an intelligent thing, but I think it's just a residual. But it's cool nonetheless.
It is. It is very cool. Something that a lot of people associate with Christmas time, obviously, there's Polar Express. Trains have always been something that is associated with more of the modern Christmas, or modern, speaking back to the 1800s, modern. But it's obviously an image that many associate with the holidays. Are there any stories involving ghost trains or anything of that nature that you're aware of around the holidays?
There is a story that is not in the, it's not around the holidays. This is one of the Christmas ones. Mm-hmm. So continuing on there, this is, you asked about phantom trains. Mm-hmm. And this story is about the crash of NBR 224. This happened in Scotland, and it involves a locomotive for the Northern British Railway. On December 28th, 1879, there was a huge storm going on. The train was approaching the Tay Bridge between Dundee and Wormit, and it was approaching it at speed. And the gale force winds were blowing and making the bridge creak. And as the train reached the middle of the bridge, the bridge was under so much stress with the locomotive going across it and the gale force winds blowing the struts underneath it that the bridge collapsed. NBR 224 and all of the cars on it went into the freezing waters of the lock. 75 people died that night, including, oddly enough, the son-in-law of the guy who designed the bridge. Some of these bodies were never recovered. They're just lost in the dark waters of the lock. The locomotive itself was actually able to be salvaged. It was raised from the bottom of the lock and put back into service. It was reconditioned and it was nicknamed the Diver, which is just ominous and creepy. And they also rebuilt the bridge using some of the struts from the old Tay Bridge. And some of the engineers that were called upon to drive this locomotive were like, nope. You think we're going to drive that locomotive over that rebuilt bridge? You are high. We're not going to do it.
Wow.
But the Diver actually remained in service until 1919. So it was still in service for a couple decades after this tragedy. But for years, witnesses have said that if you stand on the shore of the lock near the Tay Bridge at 7:15 on the night of December 28th, you know, the anniversary of the accident, you can see the ghostly lights of a locomotive coming across that bridge, and you can hear the screams of the people and the screech of the brakes as the tragedy repeats itself.
Yeah.
So There's your phantom train.
That is just a ghostly image, and just, God, just the idea of being stuck in the train car. Number one, just, you know, it combines, like, so many disasters into one, because you're falling from the sky. You're in a large transportation vehicle, so it's almost airplane crash-like in a certain way, the way you're falling down, and then it becomes...
dropping through the air, and then landing in water.
And then you're in a ship. Yeah, it's like everything, it's like, hey, it's a three-in-one. If you ever had a fear of, like, dying in a plane crash or being in a shipwreck
or drowning, or
train. It's like you get the best of all. It's so
like the trifecta of horrible ways to go.
It's so dark. Well, let's jump back into some more of the Christmas ghost stories that you cover in the book.
Absolutely.
Whatever direction you'd like to go, whether it be dark, whether it be heartwarming, I'm open. I love the Christmas ghost stories, and I'm sure the folks are enjoying hearing some Christmas ghost tales as everyone's getting ready for the holidays.
Okay, well, let's do one for Christmas Eve.
Okay.
This is the story of Sir Hugh's Goblet. This story takes place in Hatherton Hall in Staffordshire, England. This was towards the end of the 19th century. The Lord Hatherton, who lived in the hall at that point in time, he held this great big Christmas party for his friends, and the women of the couples went out to another manor house to dance for the entire evening. And Lord Hatherton and his friends met in the Lord's study and started drinking. I mean, there's cigars and there's port and there's brandy and wine and stuff. And Lord Hatherton was known for the quality of his cellars. You went to a party at his house, you knew you were going to be drinking and drinking well all evening. So the guys are milling around the study. They're having a wonderful time. And one of the men goes over to Lord Hatherton's desk, and he picks up this paperweight, and then he sets it down really quick because it's a human skull. And it's the top part of the skull, and it's lined with silver. And he puts it down. He's like, ew. He's like wiping his hands on his shirt. And Lord Hatherton picks it up, and he's, you know, tossing it from hand to hand. And he's kind of grinning. He explains what this human skull is doing on his desk in his study. He said, "This belongs to an ancestor of mine, Sir Hugh Hatherton." And Sir Hugh had been buried in a tomb in a private chapel. But somewhere along the centuries, his tomb had been ransacked, and his skull had been taken from its tomb. And one of his descendants ended up with it, and he thought it was amusing to line it with silver and use it as a goblet. Like, how cool is this? This is my ancestor's skull, and I'm drinking out of it. And some of the guests were like, oh, that's cool. And some of the guests were like, what is wrong with you?
Mm-hmm.
but Lord Hatherton was like, yeah, you know, let's make this better. Let's open a bottle of brandy from my cellars, and we'll all pass this skull around. We'll all drink from it. We'll drink Sir Hugh's health. How's that? Will that make you feel better? So that's what they did. He called a servant, and the servant got a bottle of brandy, and he fills up the skull, and he's passing it around. And everybody ended up drinking from this skull. And by this point in the evening, they're all pretty sloshed. And it gets to be about midnight, and the clock strikes midnight. And somebody had put the skull, which was now quite empty, on Lord Hatherton's desk. And as the clock struck midnight, the skull rolled off the desk and landed with a clatter on the floor. Everyone turns to look. They're like, okay, that was weird. And then they hear footsteps in the hall. And this is not the light footsteps of their wives coming home from an evening of dancing. No, these are a man's heavy footsteps coming towards the study door. And then the study door slams open, and there's the specter of a knight in full armor. And he looks around the room, and he points to Sir Hatherton, Lord Hatherton. And the knight gives this really sarcastic bow. And then he turns on his heel and he walks away down the hallway. And everyone in the study is stone cold sober at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And their wives come back from their evening of dancing about half an hour later. And everyone went to bed and some of the guys slept with the lights on. They were so freaked out. And then in the morning, they went into the study and the skull was gone. They found the silver lining of the skull outside the study window in the bushes underneath the window, but the skull itself had vanished.
Well, someone didn't like people drinking out of his brain.
Yeah, no. Not the way to impress your ancestors.
No, that just seems like a very dark way of celebrating. When you're researching this and you hear a story like that of someone using a skull as a goblet, so to speak, was that just unique to this individual, or had that been something that was done to a certain extent at a period in time?
Oh, that was definitely a thing. The Celts used to make goblets out of the skulls of their enemies because they admired them so much. They figured, hey, you know, if I drink from this guy's skull, mm-hmm. I will get his courage, the courage that he had to face me in battle, even though he lost.
Yeah.
I'll still get that mojo. So yeah, that was definitely a thing, especially with the ancient cult.
I wonder how you would clean a skull to be drinkable.
Boil it.
Okay. Yeah, I suppose that would be your best bet. You don't really have like the sanitized option on the dishwasher at that point in time.
Right.
But,
and I expect the best way to be would be to turn it over and slice off the top about the edge of the nasal cavity and use the calvarium of the skull, the cap of the skull, instead of the bottom of it. Because you had the jawbone and, you know, stuff would leak out. But if you used the cap of the skull, that would be a better way to hold liquid.
You've really thought of this, haven't you? You've...
Well, actually,
don't want to get on your bad side. Merry Christmas.
I have a skull that I use as a candy dish.
Okay.
On my table when I do book signings. It's one of the reproductions. It's from a laboratory supply house. Mm-hmm. It's not an actual skull. Okay. It's like plastic or something, but it looks realistic. And I used to take it camping and eat oatmeal out of it in the mornings. That freaked people out. It was awesome.
That would be great in a campsite. You're just sitting there. People are like, oh, let's go for our morning jog. And there you go. Oh, that's great. That's a way to get somebody to look at you. Wow. When it comes to ghost stories, obviously there's a lot of tales that go back quite a ways. How about some more present? Do you have any more present day ghost stories or accounts that people have had involving spirits, whether it be loved ones or whether it just be the house gets pretty damn active around the holidays?
I found some things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do a modern one, and then we'll go back in time and tell one of my absolute favorite
Okay.
stories.
That would be great. That wraps up part one of our Christmas ghost story episode. There's many more Christmas ghost stories to be heard. If you'd like to hear them, then become a gravekeeper at patreon.com/thegravetalks. We'll discuss about a group of Air Force men witnessing the ghost of a World War I plane while on the battlefields of World War II. In 1778, the ship General Arnold met its fate around the holidays in a very grisly way. Are the ghosts of the General Arnold still at sea today? And do the spirits of the frozen bodies who were left to thaw on the wooden floorboards of a local courthouse still haunt that very spot today? Who was lurking around a child's bedroom late one Christmas night if all the living were sleeping? And what is Sylvia's all-time favorite ghost story? All that and more in part two of our interview. Get it at patreon.com/thegravetalks. You'll have access to part two of all of our interviews, as well as advanced episodes of the program months before they are released to the public. A great way to binge away on ghost stories over the holiday break. Until next time, for the Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Happy holidays.